The Catholic Church's recent criticism of America's nuns is just the latest challenge for women of faith.
In many ways, the sisters have been underestimated.
What history can teach us about the history of America's Catholic nuns, plus a profile of a woman who revealed the beauty of mathematics. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, The Women's Perspective. According to the Vatican, America's nuns have a, quote, serious doctrinal problem. This spring, the Vatican announced its intention to reform the Leadership Conference of Women Religious, an umbrella organization that represents the leaders of most U.S. nuns. The Vatican took issue with conference statements that it says, quote, disagree with or challenge positions taken by the bishops, who are the Church's authentic teachers of faith and morals. A doctrinal assessment of the LCWR concluded it has ignored various church doctrines and has pushed what it called certain radical feminist themes incompatible with the Catholic faith. Ann Butler, author of Across God's Frontiers, Catholic Sisters in the American West, 1850 to 1920, wrote an op-ed in the New York Times in May, saying the tension between the patriarchal Catholic Church and its religious women is an old one, and cited examples from the American frontier.
These tensions have long historical roots. They certainly go as far back as European monasteries, but they are found everywhere in the story of American Catholicism or the growth of American Catholicism.
Which is not surprising. It is a patriarchal religion, and women's role has always been secondary. But you had some pretty amazing examples of what some of the nuns who went to the frontier went through.
I don't think anything prepared any Europeans for what they found in these magnificent areas of North America. One of our stereotypical images of sisters, whether in the past or the present, is that they're somehow these sort of sheltered, protected, very idealistic women who would be shocked if they heard a curse word. And these are ludicrous images of Catholic sisters, and they are certainly caricatures, and they're patronizing. I mean, American Catholic sisters and nuns have always gone into the communities where there are people in need, people living on the edges. The sisters did not live then or now some sheltered, protective life in which they were shocked by humanity. Quite the opposite. They sought out these public places where people were poor, where they were starving, where there was violence, where there was illness. And we have gotten confused because the sisters were able to construct a dual identity. They had a private life for themselves, how they chose to conduct themselves as individual women. But that had no bearing on the fact that they were workers in the public realm of society. And they engaged these people. They cared for these people. They nursed them when they were dying. They prepared their dead bodies for burial. They understood human sexuality and human pain and criminality. And their mission was to prepare or present some uplifting opposition to the life of hardship that Catholics and non-Catholics lived everywhere.
Anne, can you give me some kind of specific example of someone that you discussed who could really give people a sense of what these women did?
Mother Cabrini, who was very important in the Italian immigrant community. For example, the Mother Cabrini sisters went into the coal mines in Colorado. And those sisters would individually get into the coal bucket that was lowered down to the miners. And they would be lowered, holding on to the cable in a coal bucket in the pitch black, and so the slimy walls around them just clank, clank, down into the bottom of this mine, where miners would be rushing forward with wheelbarrows of coal, dumping the coal into the buckets the nun just climbed out of. And then these women would literally crawl through these mining spaces, speaking and praying in Italian to try to encourage the coal miners. And I think we all know that in the American West, the coal mining industry is one with a very difficult and violent history, both above the ground and below the ground. But I don't think that's an image that people usually have when they think of Catholic sisters. I think that's one really stunning example out of the American West.
And in general, how were the nuns treated by the priests that they worked with?
Well, one of the things I want to be very cautious about is I do not want anyone listening or reading anything that I have written to think that I indict all priests and clergymen of the Catholic faith, because nothing could be more inaccurate. Of course, there were wonderful priests who worked with the sisters and supported them. I mean, the priests themselves were often mired in poverty. At the same time, there is no question but that the record of the bishops who lived and worked in the American West is one that is quite tainted with an attitude of exploitation and arrogance concerning the work of Catholic sisters. A major misconception, even held by some Catholics, is that nuns are somehow supported by financially by a parish or the bishops or the Vatican. And this is not the case. Catholic sisters and nuns had to figure out how to earn their own living. And as they first came into the West, There really was no well-organized mission plan for how to manage these congregations of sisters and how to provide some structured oversight. And instead, these sisters just said, well, yes, we'll go to Montana, or yes, we'll go to the state of Washington, or yes, we'll go to Texas. And, you know, Bishop told us there would be a little cottage already, and we would be warmly greeted by the parishioners who want us to come. And in truth, these sisters would travel on a shoestring with barely any money in their pocketbooks. They would arrive in these distant and remote places, and they would find that let's say they were German immigrant sisters. Well, they would find that, oh dear, they had been sent to a community of Polish immigrants who really didn't want the German sisters. In addition, there was rarely, and I think I can say this fairly, rarely a convent prepared for the first sisters who went to a mission. Instead, they maybe were taken to an abandoned hotel where homeless people had been living that was filthy, or they were escorted to an old stable that they had to first muck out themselves before they could even lie down in it. Or they lived in a shack, or one time the sisters in the Dakotas arrived and the convent was just falling down stones. It was so unsafe that the local natives came to the sisters and said, oh, no, you can't sleep here. If there's a wind, you'll be killed. So they had to sleep out in the open. The beginning of the 1900s, as you move up towards 1920, the sisters have become much more business savvy, and they began to insist on formal contracts from local bishops or from parishes before they would send sisters. And they had 15 or 20 points that they would be explicit about. They would define how much money each sister had to be paid, and they would make it clear that they would not do the laundry for the rectory without compensation, or they would not clean the parish church. And they made it clear that their monies had to be received on the first of each month, and they made it clear that they would not hold public entertainments to raise money for the parish, and that the sisters would have access to regular religious services. So the sisters do become, I think, very astute in their business dealings, because they realize they have to support themselves. Nobody is going to just give them money to keep a convent running.
We'll continue our conversation with historian Anne Butler, author of Across God's Frontiers, and Gilles Malkin will profile a mathematician whose innovative thinking helped weave related disciplines together. If you missed part of this show or want to hear it again, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1196. Anne Butler is an historian whose book, Across God's Frontiers, Catholic Sisters in the American West, 1850 to 1920, chronicles the challenges and triumphs of Catholic nuns who braved difficult travels, physical hardships, and sometimes poor treatment by the priests and bishops with whom they worked to bring comfort to settlers in the West. She describes strong, independent women who had to work to support themselves and their order, donating their salaries and devoting themselves to service while living in poverty. It's a story she says many Americans don't know, and one that she believes is coming to light as today's American sisters face challenges to their autonomy from Rome. For people who don't understand, when you say how much each sister will be paid or what compensation will be made, as far as I know, in any order, individual sisters did not keep that money. That was then pooled to keep the community going.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And not only that, the sisters in a little mission had to support the house. They had their own medical expenses. Maybe they had educational expenses. They had to buy their groceries. They had to do the repairs. They had to cover their own travel expenses. And then they were also expected, in many congregations, to send any leftover money back to the mother house to retire the debt on the mother house and the novitiate and this sort of thing. So they lived by such a rule of frugality that I think it explains why congregations of poverty-stricken sisters were able to stabilize in the 1900s, because they just did without year in and year out. If a sister was the music teacher and she was giving music lessons before and after school, she did not keep a penny of that money. It all went into the congregation's treasury, the convent treasury, and then anything left over went back to the mother house.
And we're at a time where, once again, it looks like women in the religious life are somewhat being challenged by the church to question what authority they have over their own actions. Do you think there are lessons to be learned from those nuns back at the turn of the century?
Well, I do, and I think that, first of all, they collectively and individually, these different congregations of American sisters showed incredible courage and backbone and innovation and a great commitment to their faith and their own spirituality. And I think that in the past, that has been really little understood, little appreciated, and that in many ways the sisters have been underestimated, their strength, by not just the male clergy of their church, but also even by the laity. I think sisters have been underestimated. And I think that if people look to this past, they will see that within these congregations of religious women, there are women of enormous depth and character and integrity. And they have used those qualities to build the American Catholic Church and to serve the American Catholic Church. They have faced challenges in the past, and now they have a new set of challenges. But I think that their history shows that they are equal to those challenges.
Ann Butler is an historian and author of Across God's Frontiers, Catholic Sisters in the American West, 1850 to 1920. And finally, Gilles Malkin profiles a pioneer of another sort, a woman who devoted her life to the beauty she saw in mathematics and whose vision revealed the interconnectedness of it all.
When we think of the world's great scientists, some of the names that immediately come to mind are Aristotle, Pythagoras, Einstein, Newton. These are household names, regardless of whether or not we can explain exactly what each one did. And even though we know they must have had help, we may assume that the helpers were only secondary contributors who swept up and cleaned the blackboards. But actually, some of these provided the tools vital to opening the great bodies of knowledge gifted to us by these giant intellects. Einstein's theories are expressed in seemingly endless strings of abstract theoretical math, and one of the people who provided the original thinking that made it possible to express these ideas was a woman named Emmy Noether, known here as Emmy Noether. Her multidimensional matrix formulations provided the mathematical skeleton for the expression of Einstein's general theory of relativity. Emmy Noether was born in Bavaria in 1882. Her father was a teacher at the Mathematical Institute of Erlangen, who, despite his own talent, would later become known as Emmy's dad. She was born into a world in which women were not permitted to impart their intellectual abilities and, it goes without saying, were refused the right to earn a living, applying their gifts by teaching. It was only because her father was teaching that she was able to, although it was called lecturing, an activity she pursued there for 7 years, completely unencumbered by a salary. The academic authorities had determined that to allow women to teach would, quote, overthrow all academic order, unquote. Despite these formidable barriers, Noether earned herself a Ph.D. in mathematics by the age of 25 in 1907. From Erlangen, Noether was invited by eminent math professors to the University of Göttingen, but again the academy denied her the right to teach and to be paid. Again, she lectured for 4 years before finally being accepted in 1919 as more or less a teacher's assistant. For the next 13 years, she concentrated on teaching and developing her own theories into doors through which others could pass into more advanced mathematical thinking. Her work provided the means to think more simply and generally rather than in compacted calculations. Einstein himself, after reading the work she sent him, remarked, "Yesterday I received from Miss Noether a very interesting paper on invariants. I'm impressed that such things can be understood in such a general way. The old guard at Göttingen should take some lessons from Miss Noether. She seems to know her stuff." Her theorems were recognized not only for their truth and usefulness, but for their beauty as well. She advanced her science to new discoveries in the patterns available for use in mathematical realms. She was utterly devoted to her work and would go out of her way to help math students who were intent upon furthering their learning. Besides being known for her prowess, she found ineffable joy in doing math, and this had the effect of creating tremendous inspiration in her pupils and other mathematicians to produce higher levels of their own work. Much of their work was based upon hers, but she never sought to take any credit. When Noether addressed the International Congress of Mathematics in 1932, she had attained world renown for her intuitive algebraic perceptivity to the point that she is known today as the mother of modern algebra. In the judgment of the most competent living mathematicians, Einstein wrote of her, "Fräulein Noether was the most significant creative mathematical genius thus far produced since the higher education of women began." One of her colleagues, Hermann Weyl, expressed her personal attitude even when she was prevented by the Nazis from working by saying, "Her courage, her frankness, her unconcern about her own fate, her conciliatory spirit were, in the midst of all the hatred and meanness, despair and sorrow, a moral solace." She was ostracized by the Nazis, who were intent upon removing all Jewish teachers from university posts, and was soon after assisted by colleagues to secure a post at Bryn Mawr in Pennsylvania, where she moved in 1933. Perhaps Emmy's love for dancing engendered her penchant for passionate classroom action, to a degree that she developed her own lecturing style based primarily upon spontaneous application. She would lecture while thinking on the run, and expressed herself as she reasoned, and sweep the entire class to follow these trains of thought as far as they could go. This proved to be a fertile approach for her, as her classes became the arena for some of her finest thinking, and the notes taken later laid the groundwork for books on her mathematical theories. In a book titled Symmetry and the Beautiful Universe, physicists Leon Lederman and Christopher Hill wrote that Noether's theorem is, quote, "certainly one of the most important mathematical theorems ever proved in guiding the development of modern physics, possibly on a par with the Pythagorean theorem," unquote. Her vision led to the unification of algebra with other disciplines, including topology, geometry, logic, and linear algebra. She exposed, among other things, that certain laws of nature result from the geometry of space and time. Tragically, Emmy Noether died after an operation for an ovarian tumor in 1935 at the age of 53. Thank you for listening. For 51% and Women in History, I'm Gilles Malkin.
Gilles Malkin is a writer and musician. He lives in New York's Catskill Mountains. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. You can also find a regular column related to 51% at feminist.com. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51% of Women's Perspective.